Dropped into Juice Box Radio, where sexuality educators quench your search for responsible, progressive sexuality over your lifespan.
You've landed in Juice Box Radio 101.9 FM. Or maybe you're one of our podcast listeners. However you decide to spend this hour with us, we're very glad to have you. You're joining Julia Saunders and Caroline McGillivray. And Julia is looking at me very confused right now.
Trying to get my levels, your mojo? My levels to work. They're not working very well tonight.
Oh, darling.
That's okay. We are glad to have you. Tonight's show is going to be focusing on breast cancer and how it affects your relationships. And we're also going to be talking about other reproductive cancers tonight in the conversation.
And we've got some really dynamic guests coming on the show, two dynamic women. And each one of them has firsthand and personal experience with cancer. And instead of letting cancer beat them, they've become warriors. I know one of the things we talk about in a lot of our shows is communication. And communication is really, really key about a lot of things, whether it be in your relationship with your lover, your partner, whoever. But in particular, in terms of things like cancer, it's really, really important. One of the big movements today is basically conversations about, community conversations about cancer. And last year, I actually had the experience of meeting the wonderful Jane, and we have her on the show tonight. Welcome, Jane.
Hi, Caroline.
Hi. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Well, I'm really excited because I know in January I spoke with you and via email we were talking about having community conversations about cancer.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where I really, really wanted to do it and I wasn't able to make any of the meetings. So I figured this would be the next best thing is do it on there, talking about cancer.
Great.
So you've had firsthand experience with cancer. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Well, breast cancer among women under 40 is supposedly pretty rare, but in fact, about 900 Canadian women under the age of 40 a year do get breast cancer. 900, and in 2002, that included me. I had breast cancer diagnosed when I was 39 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
How old are you now?
Well, I just turned 46.
Okay, so you've been a survivor for a while.
Yeah.
That's good news. So, Caroline, did you mention your past experience with this, with your mom?
I haven't yet, but I was going to. Actually, last year I got to go to Victoria with Jane, and it was pretty exciting. We got to talk to a lot of the MLAs, and we had a huge group of people talking and just trying to just make some huge differences. And what was really special for me about that day was it fell on May 14th, Cancer Action Day, and it was pretty cool because that would have been my mother's birthday if she was still alive. So my mother actually died of lung cancer. And my grandmother and several of my aunts on my dad's side have died of ovarian cancer. So it's pretty prevalent in my family. So I was really, really honored. Jane's husband through Facebook had sent out some information, and I ended up contacting Jane. Because I was just like, I need to do this. It's really, really important just to make my voice heard. And I love the fact that, Jane, you've put this together, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
So how did you get involved in terms of with this particular project?
With this particular project, mm-hmm. The Community Conversations?
Yes.
Well, they kind of grew out of what we did, what you and I and the others did last year, Caroline. My group is called the Campaign to Control Cancer. It's a national coalition of cancer organizations, but I'm the chair at the provincial level. And so you and I and about 28 other mm-hmm. people from all over BC went to Victoria to talk to the MLAs about cancer control and how it can be incorporated into every ministry in the provincial government, not just the health ministry.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and that was great, and I think we were well received. But then we started thinking, well, what else can we do at the grassroots level? And we got this idea for these community conversations. They're like little mini town hall meetings. And actually, our group, the Campaign to Control Cancer, started talking about this with the Lance Armstrong Foundation, which is, of course, based in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and the International Union Against Cancer, the UICC, which is a global cancer control coalition.
Wow.
And so we've partnered with both of those organizations to hold these community conversations all over the world over the next couple of months. And what they are is they're just casual meetings. Either you can host them with your friends, with your work colleagues, with other people who you know are interested in cancer control.
Mm-hmm.
And you discuss ideas around how people can make a difference in cancer control in their own lives and also in the community.
What are some of the ideas that have come up so far, especially in regards to relationships, perhaps sexuality as well?
I hosted a community conversation, the first one in BC, 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And we had a really diverse group there. We didn't get into sexuality per se, but we did talk a lot about young people and cancer, because we had two young, when I say young, I mean quite a bit younger than me, we had two young survivors of cancer in the room, and they talked a lot about special needs of younger people who've survived cancer and the need to look at them holistically.
Okay.
The need to help them reestablish their ties to the community, to their workplace, to their friends after they've gone through cancer treatment, because often cancer treatment is long and drawn out. You may have to stop working for quite a while, for example. And then and we were talking about ways to get young cancer patients back into the groove, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the ways that you came up with?
Well, there needs to be a lot more
discussion.
Yeah, a lot more discussion, a lot more vocational rehabilitation. In other words, employers need to be really aware of the needs of workers. I guess not just young people, but any workers coming back to the workplace after a long absence for treatment. I mean, they might need to be retrained.
Mm-hmm.
They might need, they might need to talk to their colleagues about what they've been through, or they might have the need to not talk to their colleagues about what they've been through and just, get back into things,
mm-hmm.
get back into their routine.
Well, if I can just interject, I was working for the Cancer Society, Breast Cancer Society, in Vancouver here, and I guess this was about a year ago. And they were doing quite a few different campaigns around youth and breast cancer and young women, not just youth, but women, you know, under 30 kind of thing. And there was some fashion shows that were going on trying to help these cancer survivors and people that were in, women that were in the middle of treatment as well, to find ways to look good, feel better, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard of it, Jane. Mm-hmm. and it's apparently was really powerful and really effective for these young breast cancer, you know, not just survivors, but also people in treatment, that we're learning how to deal with their baldness or their, you know, just different, like losing weight or, you know, partial mastectomies, you know, lumpectomies, that kind of thing, and how to look good and how to still kind of feel sexy through that time. So it was a lot to do with their sexuality.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, I just wanted to ask you about that. Like, how do you feel about how this has affected your sexuality?
Well, it definitely had an impact, and I didn't really realize it until after I had gone through treatment, really. And that was a surprise to me that after treatment that I would have, that I would still be having issues around my self-image, my self-esteem, my sexuality, my physical appearance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're going through cancer treatment, the focus is all on survival, 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 and, you know,
getting better.
Mm-hmm. Getting better. Fair enough. But afterwards, I guess that's when a lot of the psychological stuff catches up with you. And so I found myself dealing with these issues of sexuality and self-esteem a good year and a half after I'd completed my treatment. And I thought, this is crazy, right? I must not be normal. But I went back to the cancer agency and asked for some counseling for the treatment. And
that's
I found
good.
Out that, in fact, it was perfectly normal to be going through these things so long after I'd completed treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So just hearing that helped a lot.
Yeah, it normally does, I think, a lot of counseling, even as sex counseling. I mean, people just want to hear that they are normal,
yeah.
that what they're going through is normal,
mm-hmm.
or in that normative framework. So, yeah, so that helped. So that was good.
Mm-hmm.
And then did the counseling give you some ideas on how to then move forward that you could share with our listeners, or?
Yeah, they recommended some books to read, and they assured me that my feelings were valid. You know, you might feel really silly worrying about things like your appearance when really you should be, you know, you should be grateful that you just survived, and I was grateful
mm-hmm.
that I survived.
Yeah.
So sometimes you feel guilty for also thinking about things like, well, gee, you know, I don't look, what if I can never wear like a tight t-shirt anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds really vain and trivial
not really.
The grand scheme of things, but it meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
No, well, it makes sense. It's a huge difference.
It's also very public, you know, like our bodies, women's bodies are so sexually public, and especially our breasts, they're the first thing that you kind of see besides our face. And for some people, that's the first thing they see, you know, beyond the face. So anyway, so I think it's just a very public part of our bodies. And so I think, you know, it's like you're telling your story all over the place, you know, a personal story about yourself and your health. And besides wanting to be maybe just the same sexual or sexy or, you know, attractive or whatever it is that you associate yourself with. And those things are all being affected. So I could imagine, of course you're going to think about it first and foremost. You're putting your clothes on every day and you're kind of like, okay, here's myself that I'm going to present to the world. And how do I feel about myself, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, so, and it's reminiscent of youth that are just budding in their puberty and wanting to hide any signs of of anything, or that they're different from their friends, or it's just such an awkward time and difficult time. So I can imagine there'd be some of that, almost like a return to your...
Yeah, funny that you mentioned that, actually, because I did sort of feel that way, because, you know, we're all self-conscious about our bodies when we're a teenager, and it was like, oh, man, do I have to go through this again?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
And
sounds like you came out the other end, though. Do you have any sort of recommendations for women that are sort of going through what you were going through at that time?
Well, you know, you got to talk about it. It's hard, right? It's hard to talk to a doctor or to your partner or whomever about the fact that you might not be feeling sexy.
Mm-hmm.
That's affecting everything, right? It's affecting your desire. It's affecting your self-image. It's affecting maybe the way you dress. It can have far-reaching consequences, and that's a hard thing to bring up with somebody else. But you got to do it. You have to reach out and look for that help. And it is, the onus is, unfortunately, on the patient to seek that help, because not once did any of my caregivers ever ask me anything about that, like, mm-hmm. not just specific to my sexuality or my relationship with my husband, but also just my general emotional state,
mm-hmm.
right? They're all concentrating on...
On the physical,
and caregivers tend not to ask you how you're doing emotionally.
But yet emotions come into effect so much in terms of process.
Oh, yeah. And like I say, especially afterwards. So, unfortunately, it's up to the patient to
take control.
Out that help. Yeah.
And what did you find helps? Like, when you went for counseling, did you go for counseling with your partner, or did you go for counseling individually?
I went for counseling by myself. My partner, he could have come, but I wanted to do it initially on my own just to get my bearings and see what it was all about. And I did fine with it by myself. I went back, of course, and told him what was going on, and
mm-hmm.
told him what, you know, the sorts of things that I had to think about and work on. And he was great. He was patient. But again, you know, it's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to talk about, even with your very closest
friends
or lovers.
What would you recommend for someone if their partner was going through breast cancer, just through the treatment, through the diagnosis, all of that? What would you recommend that might be some good advice that they could follow in terms of supporting their partner?
Well, I would say that it's important to support your partner, but it's also important to support yourself.
Yes.
And to make sure you take care of yourself, to think for yourself, like, how you want to handle this. For my partner, he didn't want to be really public about the fact that I was sick, because he didn't want, you know, his coworkers looking at him with sad eyes every day,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. And that was his decision, and I respected that. So he had to think a lot about, you know, how he wanted to handle this for himself. I think one thing that really helped him, though, was a lot of our friends, when they called to ask how I was doing, they would immediately ask then how he was doing. And I told him this. I said, look, you know, people are really concerned about you as well and how you're doing. So I kept telling him, you know, how other people were inquiring about him and that he wasn't forgotten in all of this, because it's really easy for the partner to be forgotten.
I can imagine that. And did any abandonment issues come up or anything like that, where he's concerned about losing you?
Not at the time. That didn't come until much, much, much later.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, I think, you know, we have a good, you know, a few, like 10 minutes here or less, and I want to just make sure that we get some of the Campaign to Control Cancer, so we want to talk a little bit about that. And I think it kind of ties in nicely that there's many myths that mm-hmm. occur with, you know, prostate cancer, breast cancer, people thinking that women under 40 don't have to really worry about getting it, and just that as a general message. And I think this is maybe what part of the Campaign to Control Cancer says, is that women, that we need to access health services, and we need to know about our bodies and that kind of thing. But are there some myths that you might want to bring up into the show tonight and talk a little bit about the campaign that you're doing?
You want me to talk about some of the myths around?
Yes, some of them, sure.
Well, it's a myth that, I think it's a myth that breast cancer in women under 40 is rare. I don't call 900 women in Canada every single year especially rare, unusual a little bit, but I don't call it rare. Also, mammograms are a very valuable tool in detecting breast cancer, but more so if you're over 40. For those under 40, mammograms might not always pick up the tumor, and that was the case with me, because women younger than 40, the breast tissue is different from older women. The breast tissue is denser, and so
yeah.
the lump might not show up on the mammogram, and that happened with me. So if I'd relied on the mammogram alone to tell me whether I had cancer or not, I wouldn't have been diagnosed.
So how did you discover your breast cancer then?
Well, diagnostically, they saw it with the ultrasound and ultimately with the biopsy. But the way I discovered it was, this is kind of funny, I just woke up in the middle of the night one night, and my finger was on my right breast, and under my finger, there was a lump. I swear, that's how it happened.
Wow.
And I knew, you know, I was familiar enough with my breast to know that this was something different and weird.
Hmm.
And then I had to go get it checked out right away. So,
So
I would encourage listeners to just be familiar with how their breasts feel so that you know if there's anything weird there, mm-hmm. you'll know that it is something different.
Right. Wow, that's a really fascinating story that your finger was on it. It's almost like...
It was freaky.
It's like your unconscious mind or the spiritual side of ourselves, you know, the intuition was touching it and kind of knowing that there is something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And waking me up and telling me to pay attention. Yeah, it was really weird.
That's really interesting. So again, that kind of, you know, I'm very much an advocate for self-healing and for self-knowledge and body knowledge and really tuning in. And so that's a beautiful story for me to hear about, just reiterating that it is possible to be that in tune to your body that you can listen to it and mm-hmm. it can guide you in the ways that you need to be guided. And I think with this breast cancer treatments like chemo and the typical ones, chemo and mastectomies and lumpectomies and things like that, that radiation, etc., that there's also other methods. And I don't know if your campaign to control cancer at all reaches into that, but do you have any experience with or knowledge about or opinion on what's called, I guess, alternative treatment?
Therapies?
I don't specifically, but I know that my oncologist here in North Vancouver was very open to exploring that sort of thing, and he's the type of doctor who never says no to anything, and I found that really refreshing. He had a very open attitude to it, and I think that's fairly true of the BC Cancer Agency as well.
Right, so alternative, and I guess it's called alternative therapies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big proponent for that, and I think it's an important thing for people to remember when they get diagnosed or they're in treatment that they consider those things and look into them.
Yeah.
So,
no, Jane, thank you so much. I'm hoping that through hopefully the campaign, hopefully through people, whoa, that was very loud, listening to the show, that hopefully more people will be talking and hopefully more people will be just talking about it, hopefully getting tested, checked out, and just really taking care. How can they find out more about the campaign and get these conversations going in their own communities?
Well, they can go to our website, controlcancer.ca. That's our main website, and there's a link on the right side of the page that takes you to our community conversations, which are leading up to a global leadership forum we're hosting in Ottawa later this year, co-hosting with the Lance Armstrong Foundation. And we're going to be presenting the best practices that have come out of these community conversations for public engagement around cancer control. And that word control is really important because one of the messages we're trying to get out there is there are things you can do about cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to sit back and worry about whether it's going to happen to you. There are things you can do to take control of your health and live a healthier lifestyle. That doesn't give you any guarantees, but it does give you some control over your overall health and your chances of getting cancer.
Like, for example?
Oh, all the classics, right? Stop smoking, don't use the tobacco, eat your fruits and veggies, get your exercise, and get engaged, right? Talk to other people about this. Think about what you'd like to see in your community to control cancer. Maybe it's reduced pesticide use. Maybe it's better cancer control measures in the workplace.
Right.
Maybe employers should be helping more to help their employees get off tobacco use to access a gymnasium, perhaps, so they can get some exercise.
And even just like, you know, I work at BC Women's Hospital and Health Center, for example, and, you know, they work pretty hard to have healthy options in the cafeteria and things like that. So, you know, just if there's a big company where it's like, yeah, they can offer good, healthy options that are available for food. And
exactly. And
I think also just giving people time. Like, one of the things I think is really important is that our work life begins to try to support the work-life balance. Mm-hmm. and let people have, like, from 10 to 7 if they want to work, or from 6 to 3 or however it is that works for you, so that you can fit your yoga class in or whatever, you know, childcare. And we need to stop with this 9 to 5 that's kind of killing a lot of us, I think.
I agree.
Or so. Perhaps what we should do is take advantage of the employers that do have yoga classes in there, or the gyms, because that's actually good for the employer too, because productivity apparently goes up 40% when employees work out during their lunch break. I thought that was a really interesting stat.
Yeah, getting a little bit of air, getting some oxygen in the blood.
Mm-hmm. Stretching those legs, feeling good and taking a break from the work and releasing the stress and feeling good and healthy.
Yes.
Well, Jane, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. That was controlcancer.ca.
And we look forward to having you again.
Thanks,
so we'll have
guys.
To catch up with you a little bit later.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Jane.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that was... I'm glad we got to talk about that a little bit on air, so, which is quite lovely. So we are going to be back in a... just after the short break with another dynamic woman who's going to be joining us on the show. And we will be talking a lot more about cancer in the next little bit and how it affects your sexuality and a lot more. We're going to be right back.
Beautiful, no matter what they say. Well, don't you bring me down today.
You know,
the February issue of Discorder magazine is on the streets now.
This month's theme is The Finding Issue, a guide to Vancouver that will introduce new wonder into your life.
Plus articles and interviews featuring Her Jazz Noise Collective, Clips, Transmission, Tight Solid, and Pretty Maps.
As always, Discorder features reviews of the newest albums and shows and the CITR program schedule.
Discorder, that 808 magazine from CITR 101.9 FM, available anywhere that's remotely cool. The first feline feel, step to haters, so I gives it to them overkill.
And if you look into a book, you might just say, I had fun, just like Run, DMC and Jay.
Flash your friends of CITR card and get discounts at Lucky's Comics, RX Comics, Magpie Magazine, People's Co-op Bookstore, and Spartacus Books. Support CITR and pick up your card today.
Juice Box is a sexuality education show geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
And we are back in the box, the juice box. And we accidentally hung up on our guest, which wasn't very good.
Sometimes this happens in the lifeline. Here we are.
Oh, she's good.
Calling
she's back. I was worried about that.
It's okay, hold on.
So if you're just joining us now, you've landed in Juicebox Radio, and we're going to have another wonderful warrior who has dealt with cancer firsthand and experienced. So welcome, Ms. Babs Chula.
Hi. I had to call back. I got disconnected.
Yes, we hung up on you. Yeah. Now, Babs, I just want to introduce you. You're one of Canada's most accomplished actors and quite a life force in the Vancouver independent film community. And I think it's really fabulous that you're going to be in the Women in Film Festival that's coming up.
Yeah.
We usually like to do a plug on our community events at the beginning of the second half of the show. And womeninfilm.ca is where you can find tickets and in-program information to see Babs. Film called Mothers and Daughters. Caroline and I are also going to the opening night film, which is called The Baby Formula, and that's director Allison Reed, who will be following a reception that starts on March 4th, and so we'll be in attendance for that and then doing a review show on that after. And Babs's film Mothers and Daughters is also in the film festival, so go to womeninfilm.ca to find out more information.
You are a busy lady, Ms. Babs.
Yes.
I know, but...
Two films?
Weird. I feel like I don't do anything, but yeah, you know. Yeah, I'm busy.
You've got one film coming out after the other, because you've got Mothers and Daughters.
Yeah, and then there's, and I believe it's the 6th, at 5th Avenue, they're opening Green Chain, which is a film I did about 2 years ago, by Mark Laren Young. A very interesting film, a very... unformulaic. You know, it's mostly talking heads, and it's an environmental film, and it's, I think, worth seeing. Good film.
Well, I think anything with you in it is worth seeing. So.
Ah, go on. That's very nice. Thank you.
Well, it's true, and you've also, I think, the industry's totally recognized you. You've won two awards as well, the Champagne Award that you're telling me about earlier. Would you like to tell our listeners a bit about that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, just let me just say that I have been in some stinkers. Okay. But I mean, you know, you can't. You're a little bit a victim of this industry as much as you are. You know, as much as it may appear that you're in control, and I'm very flattered by the kind of attention I've gotten lately, but you know, you basically work at anything that's offered to you, and sometimes that's real garbage. But nevertheless, the Sam Payne Award, Sam Payne was a guy who was here in Vancouver. Yeah, Sam Payne.
I really thought you said champagne when we talked.
Well, sounds more fun.
I heard you just say champagne, and I thought... What a fantastic thing to call the Sam Payne Award, the Champagne Award. But that's what you say after a few drinks, you see. And you try and explain the Sam Payne Award, you just slur your words. The Sam Payne Award. He was an actor and a director, and I never met him, but I certainly had heard his name over the years.
Mm-hmm.
He died, I believe, in 1982, maybe 83, somewhere in the early 80s. And the union put together a sort of tribute award in his name because of his qualities, the qualities about this guy that they wanted to recognize in someone each year. And those qualities are honesty and integrity and the encouragement of new young talent. And I won it this year, which absolutely floors me.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled.
And you're Woman of the Year, are you not?
Yeah, Woman of the Year. Yeah.
So, wow.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, that is really, that's another one. I mean, yeah, I'm just sort of, of this illness, you know, maybe people think I'm going to die or something, and they're like, you know, giving me all these awards because they don't want to wait till I'm dead. But, I mean, I have every intention of, you know, being 95 years old someday, so I'm just going to have to win these awards twice.
Yeah, you know, I think you're being recognized because of the work you've done. Mm-hmm. And
great achievement. I hope so.
Yes, I don't think it's because you're impending, maybe dying. I don't think so. But let's talk about this. You're back on the fighting train for your life, by the sounds of it. So you had a diagnosis of breast cancer. You had a mastectomy.
Yeah, I have a very complicated situation. I have two active cancers. I was diagnosed in 2001 with breast cancer, and I was diagnosed in 2003 with blood cancer, a blood cancer that had not displayed, but that I had had prior to the breast cancer and had not been detected.
Okay.
So when my breast cancer, very complicated, mm-hmm. and dealing with it has been complicated, and quite frankly, I don't think that there was ever a great expectation that I would necessarily survive any of this, because there hadn't been a precedent set like this, and not with my doctors, and because, you know, I think really what has the secret to the success of the last 7 years for me has been, the success being that I've been able to stay alive, you know, has been that I really, at the very beginning, and especially at the beginning of the second diagnosis, I realized that my safety is what was in being vulnerable and in deciding to be transparent about this illness. Because it's such a lonely, lonely place to be and a frightening place to be, a diagnosis of cancer. And this particular two diagnoses was, you know, overwhelming. And I thought, if I'm going to be safe in any way, or even the illusion of safety, I'm going to have to just be completely transparent.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to do that. And in doing that, I found my support. You know, and I found my empowerment. So I think there's a lesson in that. You know, I'm really careful not to tell people what to do. I think each person has to find and pick their way very carefully through a cancer diagnosis and treatment choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of people call me and say, what did you do? What did you do? You know, in that panic that one feels when they're first diagnosed. And you know, I'm very careful because, I mean, I'm not careful to share my information. I'm careful that people don't get the idea that this is what you do.
Right.
Because I think each person has to find their own way. And
it's a personal journey.
And it's because each diagnosis of cancer is really specific, which is why the industry kind of finding formulaic, answers to each individual cancer, you know, protocols,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, it makes sense in terms of a big industry, but it doesn't really make sense to me in terms of individual needs.
So it's really important to get people talking about cancer and and just get the communication going.
Yeah, and the stigmas are huge. They're huge because, you know, I'm not a timid person, you know, and I never was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that doesn't mean I'm necessarily courageous. I'm just not timid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you that the very first thing I felt when I was diagnosed was shame. And I have found since that most people feel ashamed when they're diagnosed with cancer, like as if they've failed. And I'm not sure if that's a function of the way that this disease has been marketed. You know, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. It rests and depends a lot on fear and lots of decisions are based on fear and driven by fear. And you know, I don't know who the culprit is. I don't know if it's pharmaceutical companies or a combination of a lot of things. But you know, I don't think there's anything else that where people go to a doctor and say, "Take care of me, just fix it. Whatever you do, fix it." And then don't ask questions, because it's hard to ask questions. You know, you got people looking at their watches and rolling their eyes up in their head, and because any questions about alternatives or rumored possibilities or internet or you know are met with skepticism and suspicion, and it's a pretty closed industry. So you know it's hard to find your path. You know, but you know, education, being educated and informed about your own disease, and realizing that you're driving the car is the first thing that gives you any power at all, you know. So it's the only way that shame dissipates.
I think in general, disease is definitely, and I agree, you need to dissipate that through communication, getting the word out there.
It's so weird.
It is. I think a lot of disease, actually, like whether it's cancer, whether it's HIV, whether or not it's herpes, gonorrhea, it doesn't matter. It's I think it affects regardless whether it's blood cancer, whether it be breast cancer.
Yeah, well, I think breast cancer is a tricky one.
It's
because it's really nipple cancer. I mean, there is something specifically, you know, a cancer of the nipple.
You were mentioning, actually, on the break, that not one person mentioned the word nipple.
Not one time in my entire diagnosis did I have the word nipple brought to my attention. And the truth is that missing the breast, losing the breast, it's traumatic, and it was for me. I can't do it.
I can imagine. I can imagine most women.
It was for me. It was very, very difficult. But losing the mass of fat that was the bulk of my breast was not a big deal. I mean, we have that part of our breast, you know, built and taken away, and you know, all kinds of it changes over time. You know, the firmness of our breasts, but. Losing my nipple I was gobsmacked. I couldn't believe it was like losing my eye. You know, and it affected my sense of myself as a sexual creature, and it affected my response, my sexual response, for God's sake.
Yeah, I could imagine it would. I mean, it's a lifeline to your genitals, really.
Absolutely.
Your nipples. So,
lots of women don't necessarily, you know, feel that the breasts are really involved in their own, you know, pleasures. But, you know, and I mean, I've heard that before. I've heard women say, oh, I could lose my breasts. It wouldn't be a big deal. Well, not for me. For me, it was a big deal, and it still is. And the shame's gone, you know what I mean? It's not about shame, and it's just the reality. The reality is that I am less turned on with one nipple.
It makes sense.
Two.
One of my ex-boyfriends used to always describe nipples as the doorbell to the clit.
Well, hey, that's the truth. That's the truth in my case.
I think it is in a lot of women's cases.
So it has affected your sexuality.
Absolutely.
And what about your relationships?
Well, you know, I'm in a fantastic marriage. I'm married to a really extraordinary human being, beautiful man. The night before my mastectomy, my children and my husband and my friend from New York and a number of people who are close to me that were involved in my journey at the very beginning, we had a say goodbye to mom's breast dinner. And we had chicken breasts. And no, I'm kidding. We didn't.
Okay.
I don't remember what we had. But and I'm a vegetarian anyway. But we had
sense of humor. I think gets you a long way with cancer.
No, we didn't. But we did all take off our shirts. My grandchildren were horrified. They thought we were weird. And you know, like ages, I don't know, 7 and 9.
What an awesome grandma you must.
Yeah, I do. I have an awesome family, and you know, and all of my kids kissed my breast goodbye, and then I stood in front of everybody and I held it back as if it weren't there. And my beautiful husband said, who's from Philadelphia and has a funny accent, said, "Barbara, it looks like Picasso. And I thought, that he is the most awesome guy in the world. He has got to be. But he's also so awesome that in the weeks and months that followed the surgery, and when I began to feel sexual again and longed for intimacy again, you know, with sexual intimacy, you know, and found it so difficult, he also was able to tell me that it was really hard for him. You know, he wasn't one of these guys that said it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It matters. And it mattered to him, and he had the courage to tell me it mattered, and he really missed my breast. And he really missed my nipple.
What do you recommend, Babs, for partners then to deal with, you know, their partners having breast cancer? Or
what do I recommend? God, I don't know. I guess I recommend, you know, being with the right person. I know a lot of people don't survive the you know, the challenge. A lot of marriages don't survive.
Right.
I know of many that haven't survived. I think of more that haven't survived than that have. That haven't survived breast cancer, you know, like in 10 years later and 5 years later. And I think it's, you know, I think it's maybe a little bit about losing the breast, the actual reality of losing the breast. But I think that what ultimately happens is that the person with cancer, and I say that because men get breast cancer too, you know, but I mean, the person with cancer, no matter what kind of cancer you have, either becomes empowered or succumbs. And that can change a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it sometimes has nothing to do with sexuality. You know, it has to do with making your own decisions, maybe, for the first time, or bucking the system, maybe, for the first time, or you know, asking for space and privacy for the first time in relationships. I don't know. There are so many things involved. It just could be anything. I don't know what to recommend, except always to be as honest as you can with your partner.
Well, it sounds like you and your partner have a very healthy relationship, where you're able
to
communicate, and you're able to communicate in a way where he was able to, felt comfortable enough to talk to you, and you're able to converse back, where sometimes people aren't able to do that without a mediator or without a counselor
then
to
get
kind
one.
Of guide through the process.
You know, then get a mediator.
That's true.
I mean, it's like, really, think about it, you know, like, how much stress do you want to put yourself through?
Exactly.
You know,
good question.
You don't want your marriages breaking up because of this. This is like, I mean, really, giving it that kind of power is crazy.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that our earlier guest Jane had said was just around the counseling and how important it is. And you know, a good place to start is the Cancer Society counseling. But you know, I think, you know, they may be able to recommend others, or if you have specific relationship issues or sexuality issues or whatever, they may have you know, good recommendations. But I think what we're talking about here is how important it is to not try to do it alone. And I just want to say that, you know, I think it's a beautiful thing that you, Babs, are doing this Lifeline for Artists Society.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Because this is about coming together and supporting each other, by the sounds of it. But I'll let you describe it better, because I'm trying to do a better job.
Gosh, you know, okay, so I had breast cancer. I'm diagnosed with breast cancer, and then, you know, right away, a protocol is suggested to you. And, you know, BC Medical has a formulary which lists, you know, allowable drugs and chemos that, you know, refer to your cancer specifically. And I don't know, each of us as individuals, some of those things don't work for everybody. I had a very unusual and wonky blood profile. When I started to ask questions, I knew nothing when I was diagnosed, okay? But I got educated really quickly. And when I started to ask questions about, you know, treatment and how the treatment that was being suggested to me by BC Cancer Agency was going to affect me, I started finding out that the risks that I was taking by doing the chemos that they were recommending was greater than the possibility of my healing from So,
this is what,
you know,
I've heard too.
And
sometimes,
when I started asking questions, I was met with such arrogance. I was floored. In fact, I left the oncologist that had been assigned to me, and found, not knowing where I was going to go, and found a doctor who was at least willing to negotiate with me and answer questions for me,
right.
who ultimately said to me, off the record, and very clearly off the record, because he could not take the risk that he would be quoted, you know, said to me, if you were my own daughter and you had a blood profile that looked like this, I would question chemotherapy as well. Now, it turned out that 2 years later, I was diagnosed with blood cancer. And had I not followed my intuition and had the chemo that was recommended, I would have killed myself. They would have killed me. Let's say that.
Wow.
Let's say it like it is.
I believe it.
I would not have survived, okay?
Wow.
But I didn't do the chemo and radiation that was suggested, the protocol that was suggested, because I believed that if I strengthened my immune system, I would be able to stave off any metastases. And in fact, I did, and I did for 5 years.
That's so awesome.
I
love to hear these stories because
yeah,
I've heard them
I
before.
Did. And I went for alternatives, and it was, we spent every penny we had, every penny, and every donation, every bit of help anybody gave us, every bit of disability, every bit of, I mean, we spent more than $80,000 in a year and a half.
Wow.
We have, and that's why I started the Babs Tubal Society, because as artists,
you don't have that kind of money to throw around unless you've really made it in life.
That kind of money in a whole lifetime for us to even have a life savings of that you know kind of heft was you know, really unusual. But we're both in the same business, and my husband is a cinematographer and makes a different kind of paycheck than I did at one point. He doesn't anymore because the industry is different now. But you know, we don't have any savings. We spent the RRSPs and we spent everything just paying for alternatives. Because, you know, you don't get the option. BC Medical doesn't say you get to choose your treatment. If you don't take the protocol that is offered to you by BC Cancer Agency, you are considered having refused treatment.
Really? Wow.
It's not considered a choice. You take it or you refuse treatment.
Wow.
So to choose alternative treatments doesn't mean anything to them.
Hmm.
It means you've refused.
That's
so
interesting.
Your insurance companies hear that, you see. Your insurance companies, if you don't take the protocol, if you're not willing to take the protocol, your insurance companies also have the right to cut off your payments because they can say you've refused treatment, which is what ended up happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
Since I had refused treatment and I was on alternatives, which they don't recognize, and you don't have the choice to say to BC Medical, I know I'm having treatment. They're just alternative treatments, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they should be paid for through my BC Medical, but BC Medical is in bed with the pharmaceutical companies. So,
yes,
you know,
for sure.
So you don't get those kinds of choices, and you have to pay out of pocket.
What type of alternative therapies, because I know the Cancer Society, they do have, I'm trying to remember what their center's called, but where they've got like yoga classes, meditation.
Well, yeah,
and
I mean,
acupuncture.
Yoga classes and meditation and far infrared saunas and colonics, and those things are all, you need to do all of those things together, and some of those things work better than others, but none of those things are a cure for cancer. You know, I at one point was taking a drug called Ukraine, which is a naturopathic, it's made from a plant, and it's a liver plant. It's an ancient plant that's been used for hundreds and hundreds of years in many different forms. It was as expensive as chemo, but I couldn't get, you know, I had to pay out of pocket for it, and you know, and it's given intravenously, and and massive doses of vitamin C given intravenously aren't covered, and you know, you can't just take a yoga class and do some meditation and expect to heal your cancer.
Right.
So, you know, the kinds of things they offer are lovely. Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's lovely. I love that they offer that stuff. I mean, it's important. But those aren't the things that cure cancer. It's the heavy-duty treatments that cure cancer.
So if somebody wants to donate to the Babs Tubal Society, how do they go about doing that?
Like, well, they go to Babs Tubal Society, one word, lowercase, .org,
Okay.
And but there's Babs is spelled B-A-B-Z.
B-A-B-Z-C-H-U-L-A.
Chula
Society.
Society.org. Yes. Okay.
And my blog is there. I mean, you know, I have to put a new
new post.
Entry in my new post in my blog. Yes, I've been negligent. But things have changed in the last couple of weeks, and so it's been a while. I've had to come to some conclusions. I was, you know, so now I know what I need to write in there. But you
great.
Know. But
still, that's where people can donate or find out
yep,
more, get in touch with you.
That's where people can find out about the organization.
Wonderful.
And this is the year when we will start raising money for somebody new. And we already have established our huge yearly event, which is in November, and it's a gala. And we're already starting to put together our gala for next November. So
I give you kudos for that. That's
yeah, thank you.
It's really difficult to do those, and
yeah,
hats off to you. And
thank you. I'm so proud of that because that will live way beyond me.
Wow.
You know, that's the idea.
Yeah.
And you know, at one point, and this is really if I'm gonna close on something, what I want to say, and I think the element that is closest to allowing one to heal are the gestures of generosity that we make towards others.
Mm.
And I really, really believe that that's where the healing lives. And so it became so important to me with the transparency that I decided to display, it became so important to me to be able to give something to others that you know, the real kernel that the society grew from was the idea, the gesture of giving that comes from setting something up to help people.
Well, I think that's awesome, and I'm hoping that we get some people who will be donating.
That
and
would be awesome.
Hopefully as well as that, just with our first guest
as well.
It'd
be so beautiful.
I think it'll be great, and getting people talking and giving and hopefully making a huge difference.
Well, yeah, ask questions, and it's, as hard as it is, you know, try to bury that shame about it and know that you didn't do anything wrong, and get educated. And, you know, there's so much power in knowledge. And
just taking advantage and seizing it.
This is your body.
Yes. Well, thank
your body.
Thank you, Babs, for being on the show tonight. We have to close. So thanks so much, and we'll have you on again. You're a fiery little thing.
Yeah, oh, well, thank you.
And,
it's been a pleasure.
Bless you.
Can't wait to see you at the festival, so it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, you definitely come up to me and shake me.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
Okay, just don't poke me in the boob. Okay?
The one left.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, we hope you've enjoyed tonight's show. That was pretty awesome. It's two fantastic guests on. And with that, I hope everybody's going to be talking about cancer and having these really great conversations, as well as checking out Mothers and Daughters at the Women in Film Festival, which is pretty exciting.
So up next, we have one of our favorite
I haven't even looked at the shoes yet.
I know. And we're over time now, so we have to sign off and give him his fair airtime. Our sexy man.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening.
We'll be back next week at the sexy hour at 10 o'clock.
You just experienced Juicebox Radio, a show dedicated to developing your relational and individual sexual health, expressing diversity, celebrating queerness, and encouraging pleasure at all stages. Be sure to tune into Juicebox every Wednesday night at 10. In the meantime, you can check out juiceboxradio.com. Thanks for listening.